Random House Audible presents Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser, read by Rick Adamson.
Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. Fast Food Nation. Cheyenne Mountain sits on the eastern slope of Colorado's Front Range, rising steeply from the prairie and overlooking the city of Colorado Springs. From a distance, the mountain appears beautiful and serene, dotted with rocky outcroppings, scrub oak, and ponderosa pine. It looks like the backdrop of an old Hollywood Western, just another gorgeous Rocky Mountain vista. And yet, Cheyenne Mountain is hardly pristine. One of the nation's most important military installations lies deep within it, housing units of the North American Aerospace Command, the Air Force Space Command, and the United States Space Command. During the mid-1950s, high-level officials at the Pentagon worried that America's air defenses had become vulnerable to sabotage and attack. Cheyenne Mountain was chosen as the site for a top-secret underground combat operations center. The mountain was hollowed out, and 15 buildings, most of them three stories high, were erected amid a maze of tunnels and passageways extending for miles. The 4.5-acre underground complex was designed to survive a direct hit by an atomic bomb. Now officially called the Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Station, the facility is entered through steel blast doors that are 3 feet thick and weigh 25 tons each. They automatically swing shut in less than 20 seconds. The base is closed to the public, and a heavy armed quick response team guards against intruders. Pressurized air within the complex prevents contamination by radioactive fallout and biological weapons. The buildings are mounted on gigantic steel springs to ride out an earthquake or the blast wave of a thermonuclear strike. The hallways and staircases are painted slate gray, the ceilings are low, and there are combination locks on many of the doors. A narrow escape tunnel, entered through a metal hatch, twists and turns its way out of the mountain through solid rock. The place feels like the set of an early James Bond movie, with men in jumpsuits driving little electric vans from one brightly lit cavern to another. 1,500 people work inside the mountain, maintaining the facility and collecting information from a worldwide network of radars, spy satellites, ground-based sensors, airplanes, and blimps. The Cheyenne Mountain Operations Center tracks every man-made object that enters North American airspace or that orbits the Earth. It is the heart of the nation's early warning system. It can detect the firing of a long-range missile anywhere in the world before that missile has left the launch pad. This futuristic military base inside a mountain has the capability to be self-sustaining for at least 1 month. Its generators can produce enough electricity to power a city the size of Tampa, Florida. Its underground reservoirs hold millions of gallons of water. Workers sometimes traverse them in rowboats. The complex has its own underground fitness center, a medical clinic, a dentist's office, a barber shop, a chapel, and a cafeteria. When the men and women stationed at Cheyenne Mountain get tired of the food in the cafeteria, they often send somebody over to the Burger King at Fort Carson, a nearby Army base, or they call Domino's. Almost every night, a Domino's delivery man winds his way up the lonely Cheyenne Mountain Road, past the ominous deadly force authorized signs, past the security checkpoint at the entrance of the base, driving toward the heavily guarded north portal, tucked behind chain link and barbed wire. Near the spot where the road heads straight into the mountainside, the delivery man drops off his pizzas and collects his tip. And should Armageddon come, should a foreign enemy someday shower the United States with nuclear warheads, laying waste to the whole continent, entombed within Cheyenne Mountain, along with the high-tech marvels, the pale blue jumpsuits, comic books, and Bibles, future archaeologists may find other clues to the nature of our civilization. Big King wrappers, barbecue wing bones, and the red, white, and blue of a Domino's pizza box. Over the last three decades, fast food has infiltrated every nook and cranny of American society. An industry that began with a handful of modest hot dog and hamburger stands in Southern California has spread to every corner of the nation, selling a broad range of foods wherever paying customers may be found. Fast food is now served at restaurants and drive-thrus, at stadiums, airports, zoos, high schools, elementary schools, and universities, on cruise ships, trains, and airplanes, at Kmarts, Walmarts, gas stations, and even at hospital cafeterias. In 1970, Americans spent about $6 billion on fast food. In 2000, they spent more than $110 billion. Americans now spend more money on fast food than on higher education, personal computers, computer software, or new cars. They spend more on fast food than on movies, books, magazines, newspapers, videos, and recorded music combined. Pull open the glass door. Feel the rush of cool air. Walk in, get online, study the backlit color photographs above the counter, place your order, hand over a few dollars, watch teenagers in uniforms pushing various buttons, and moments later, take hold of a plastic tray full of food wrapped in colored paper and cardboard. The whole experience of buying fast food has become so routine, so thoroughly unexceptional and mundane, that it's now taken for granted, like brushing your teeth or stopping for a red light. It has become a social custom, as American as a small rectangular handheld frozen and reheated apple pie. Fast food has proven to be a revolutionary force in American life. I am interested in it both as a commodity and as a metaphor. What people eat, or don't eat, has always been determined by a complex interplay of social, economic, and technological forces. The early Roman Republic was fed by its citizen farmers, the Roman Empire by its slaves. A nation's diet can be more revealing than its art or literature. On any given day in the United States, about one quarter of the adult population visits a fast food restaurant. During a relatively brief period of time, the fast food industry has helped to transform not only the American diet, but also our landscape, economy, workforce, and popular culture. Fast food and its consequences have become inescapable, regardless of whether you eat it twice a day, try to avoid it, or have never taken a single bite. The extraordinary growth of the fast food industry has been driven by fundamental changes in American society. Adjusted for inflation, the hourly wage of the average U.S. worker peaked in 1973 and then steadily declined for the next 25 years. During that period, women entered the workforce in record numbers, often motivated less by a feminist perspective than by a need to pay the bills. In 1975, about one-third of American mothers with young children worked outside the home. Today, almost two-thirds of such mothers are employed. As the sociologists Cameron Lynn McDonald and Carmen Siriani have noted, the entry of so many women into the workforce has greatly increased demand for the types of services that housewives traditionally perform: cooking, cleaning, and child care. A generation ago, three-quarters of the money used to buy food in the United States was spent to prepare meals at home. Today, about half of the money used to buy food is spent at restaurants, mainly at fast food restaurants. The McDonald's Corporation has become a powerful symbol of America's service economy, which is now responsible for 90% of the country's new jobs. In 1968, McDonald's operated about 1,000 restaurants. Today, it has about 28,000 restaurants worldwide and opens almost 2,000 new ones each year. An estimated one out of every eight workers in the United States has at some point been employed by McDonald's. The company annually hires about 1 million people, more than any other American organization, public or private. McDonald's is the nation's largest purchaser of beef, pork, and potatoes, and the second largest purchaser of chicken. The McDonald's Corporation is the largest owner of retail property in the world. Indeed, the company earns the majority of its profits not from selling food, but from collecting rent. McDonald's spends more money on advertising and marketing than any other brand. As a result, it has replaced Coca-Cola as the world's most famous brand. McDonald's operates more playgrounds than any other private entity in the United States. It is one of the nation's largest distributors of toys. A survey of American schoolchildren found that 96% could identify Ronald McDonald. The only fictional character with a higher degree of recognition was Santa Claus. The impact of McDonald's on the way we live today is hard to overstate. The Golden Arches are now more widely recognized than the Christian cross. In the early 1970s, the farm activist Jim Hightower warned of the McDonaldization of America. He viewed the emerging fast food industry as a threat to independent businesses, as a step toward a food economy dominated by giant corporations, and as a homogenizing influence on American life. In Eat Your Heart Out, 1975, he argued that bigger is not better. Much of what Hightower feared has come to pass. The centralized purchasing decisions of the large restaurant chains and their demand for standardized products have given a handful of corporations an unprecedented degree of power over the nation's food supply. Moreover, the tremendous success of the fast food industry has encouraged other industries to adopt similar business methods. The basic thinking behind fast food has become the operating system of today's retail economy, wiping out small businesses, obliterating regional differences, and spreading identical stores throughout the country like a self-replicating code. America's main streets and malls now boast the same Pizza Huts and Taco Bells, Gaps, and Banana Republics. Almost every facet of American life has now been franchised or chained. From the maternity ward at a Columbia HCA hospital to an embalming room owned by Service Corporation International, the world's largest provider of death care services based in Houston, Texas, which today handles the final remains of one out of every 9 Americans, a person can now go from the cradle to the grave without spending a nickel at an independently owned business. The key to a successful franchise, according to many texts on the subject, can be expressed in one word: uniformity. Franchises and chain stores strive to offer exactly the same product or service at numerous locations. Customers are drawn to familiar brands by an instinct to avoid the unknown. A brand offers a feeling of reassurance when its products are always and everywhere the same. We have found out that we cannot trust some people who are nonconformists, declared Ray Kroc, one of the founders of McDonald's, angered by some of his franchisees. We will make conformists out of them in a hurry. The organization cannot trust the individual. The individual must trust the organization. One of the ironies of America's fast food industry is that a business so dedicated to conformity was founded by iconoclasts and self-made men, by entrepreneurs willing to defy conventional opinion. Few of the people who built fast food empires ever attended college, let alone business school. They worked hard, took risks, and followed their own paths. In many respects, the fast food industry embodies the best and the worst of American capitalism at the start of the 21st century. Its constant stream of new products and innovations, its widening gulf between rich and poor. The industrialization of the restaurant kitchen has enabled the fast food chains to rely upon a low-paid and unskilled workforce. While a handful of workers manage to rise up the corporate ladder, the vast majority lack full-time employment, receive no benefits, learn few skills, exercise little control over their workplace, quit after a few months, and float from job to job. The restaurant industry is now America's largest private employer, and it pays some of the lowest wages. A hamburger and French fries became the quintessential American meal in the 1950s, thanks to the promotional efforts of the fast food chains. The typical American now consumes approximately 3 hamburgers and 4 orders of French fries every week. But the steady barrage of fast food ads, full of thick, juicy burgers and long golden fries, rarely mentions where these foods come from nowadays, or what ingredients they contain. The birth of the fast food industry coincided with Eisenhower-era glorifications of technology, with optimistic slogans like "Better Living Through Chemistry" and "Our Friend the Atom." The sort of technological wizardry that Walt Disney promoted on television and at Disneyland eventually reached its fulfillment in the kitchens of fast food restaurants. Indeed, the corporate culture of McDonald's seems inextricably linked to that of the Disney Empire, sharing a reverence for sleek machinery, electronics, and automation. The leading fast food chains still embrace a boundless faith in science, and as a result, have changed not just what Americans eat, but also how their food is made. The current methods for preparing fast food are less likely to be found in cookbooks than in trade journals such as Food Technologist and Food Engineering. Aside from the salad greens and tomatoes, most fast food is delivered to the restaurant already frozen, canned, dehydrated, or freeze-dried. A fast food kitchen is merely the final stage in a vast and highly complex system of mass production. Foods that may look familiar have in fact been completely reformulated. What we eat has changed more in the last 40 years than in the previous 40,000. Like Cheyenne Mountain, today's fast food conceals remarkable technological advances behind an ordinary-looking facade. Much of the taste and aroma of fast food, for example, is now manufactured at a series of large chemical plants off the New Jersey Turnpike. In the fast food restaurants of Colorado Springs, behind the counters, amid the plastic seats, in the changing landscape outside the window, you can see all the virtues and destructiveness of our fast food nation. I chose Colorado Springs as a focal point because the changes that have recently swept through the city are emblematic of those that fast food and the fast food mentality have encouraged throughout the United States. Countless other suburban communities in every part of the country could have been used to illustrate the same points. The extraordinary growth of Colorado Springs neatly parallels that of the fast food industry. During the last few decades, the city's population has more than doubled. The Rocky Mountain region as a whole has the fastest growing economy in the United States, mixing high-tech and service industries in a way that may define America's workforce for years to come. And new restaurants are opening there at a faster pace than anywhere else in the nation. Fast food is now so commonplace that it has acquired an air of inevitability, as though it were somehow unavoidable, a fact of modern life. And yet, the dominance of the fast food giants was no more preordained than the march of colonial split levels, golf courses, and man-made lakes across the deserts of the American West. The political philosophy that now prevails in so much of the West, with its demand for lower taxes, smaller government, and unbridled free market, stands in total contradiction to the region's true economic underpinnings. No other region of the United States has been so dependent on government subsidies for so long, from the 19th century construction of its railroads to the 20th century financing of its military bases and dams. One historian has described the federal government's 1950s highway building binge as a case study in interstate socialism, a phrase that aptly describes how the West was really won. The fast food industry took root alongside that interstate highway system as a new form of restaurant sprang up beside the new off-ramps. Moreover, the extraordinary growth of this industry over the past quarter century did not occur in a political vacuum. It took place during a period when the inflation-adjusted value of the minimum wage declined by about 40%, when sophisticated mass marketing techniques were for the first time directed at small children, and when federal agencies created to protect workers and consumers too often behaved like branch offices of the companies that were supposed to be regulated. Ever since the administration of President Richard Nixon, the fast food industry has worked closely with its allies in Congress and the White House to oppose new worker safety, food safety, and minimum wage laws. In the potato fields and processing plants of Idaho, in the ranchlands east of Colorado Springs, in the feedlots and slaughterhouses of the High Plains, you can see the effects of fast food on the nation's rural life, its environment, its workers, and its health. The fast food chains now stand atop a huge food industrial complex that has gained control of American agriculture. During the 1980s, large multinationals such as Cargill, ConAgra, and IBP were allowed to dominate one commodity market after another. Farmers and cattle ranchers are losing their independence, essentially becoming hired hands for the agribusiness giants or being forced off the land. Family farms are now being replaced by gigantic corporate farms with absentee owners. Rural communities are losing their middle class and becoming socially stratified, divided between a small wealthy elite and large numbers of the working poor. Small towns that seemingly belong in a Norman Rockwell painting are being turned into rural ghettos. The hardy independent farmers whom Thomas Jefferson considered the bedrock of American democracy are a truly vanishing breed. The United States now has more prison inmates than full-time farmers. The fast food chain's vast purchasing power and their demand for a uniform product have encouraged fundamental changes in how cattle are raised, slaughtered, and processed into ground beef. These changes have made meatpacking, once a highly skilled, highly paid occupation, into the most dangerous job in the United States, performed by armies of poor, transient immigrants whose injuries often go unrecorded and uncompensated. And the same meat industry practices that endanger these workers have facilitated the introduction of deadly pathogens, such as E. coli 0157H7, into America's hamburger meat, a food aggressively marketed to children. Again and again, efforts to prevent the sale of tainted ground beef have been thwarted by meat industry lobbyists and their allies in Congress. The federal government has the legal authority to recall a defective toaster oven or stuffed animal, but still lacks the power to recall tons of contaminated, potentially lethal meat. I do not mean to suggest that fast food is solely responsible for every social problem now haunting the United States. In some cases, such as the mauling and sprawling of the West, the fast food industry has been a catalyst and a symptom of larger economic trends. In other cases, such as the rise of franchising and the spread of obesity, fast food has played a more central role. By tracing the diverse influences of fast food, I hope to shed light not only on the workings of an important industry, but also on a distinctively American way of viewing the world. Elitists have always looked down at fast food, criticizing how it tastes and regarding it as another tacky manifestation of American popular culture. The aesthetics of fast food are of much less concern to me than its impact upon the lives of ordinary Americans, both as workers and consumers. Most of all, I am concerned about its impact on the nation's children. Fast food is heavily marketed to children and prepared by people who are barely older than children. This is an industry that both feeds and feeds off the young. During the 2 years spent researching this book, I ate an enormous amount of fast food. Most of it tasted pretty good. That is one of the main reasons people buy fast food. It has been carefully designed to taste good. It's also inexpensive and convenient. But the value-for-one deals and free refills of soda give a distorted sense of how much fast food actually costs. The real price never appears on the menu. Hundreds of millions of people buy fast food every day without giving it much thought, unaware of the subtle and not-so-subtle ramifications of their purchases. They rarely consider where this food came from, how it was made, what it's doing to the community around them. They just grab their tray off the counter, find a table, take a seat, unwrap the paper, and dig in. The whole experience is transitory and soon forgotten. I've written this book out of a belief that people should know what lies behind the shiny, happy surface of every fast food transaction. They should know what really lurks between those sesame seed buns. As the old saying goes, you are what you eat. The Founding Fathers. Carl N. Karcher is one of the fast food industry's pioneers. His career extends from the industry's modest origins to its current hamburger hegemony. His life seems at once to be a tale by Horatio Alger, a fulfillment of the American dream, and a warning about unintended consequences. It is a fast food parable about how the industry started and where it can lead. At the heart of the story is Southern California, whose cities became prototypes for the rest of the nation, whose love of the automobile changed what America looks like and what Americans eat. Carl was born in 1917 on a farm near Upper Sandusky, Ohio. His father was a sharecropper who moved the family to new land every few years. The Karchers were German-American, industrious, and devoutly Catholic. Carl dropped out of school after the eighth grade and worked 12 to 14 hours a day on the farm, harvesting with a team of horses, baling hay, milking and feeding the cows. In 1937, Ben Karcher, one of Carl's uncles, offered him a job in Anaheim, California. After thinking long and hard and consulting with his parents, Carl decided to go west. He was 20 years old and 6'4", a big, strong farm boy. He had never set foot outside of northern Ohio. The decision to leave home felt momentous, and the drive to California took a week. When he arrived in Anaheim and saw the palm trees and orange groves and smelled the citrus in the air, Carl said to himself, "This is heaven." Anaheim was a small town in those days, surrounded by ranches and farms. It was located in the heart of Southern California's citrus belt, an area that produced almost all of the state's oranges, lemons, and tangerines. Orange County and neighboring Los Angeles County were the leading agricultural counties in the United States, growing fruits, nuts, vegetables, and flowers on land that only a generation earlier had been a desert covered in sagebrush and cactus. Massive irrigation projects, built with public money to improve private land, brought water from hundreds of miles away. Small ranches and dairy farms dotted the land, and sunflowers lined the back roads. Anaheim had been settled in the late 19th century by German immigrants hoping to create a local wine industry, and by a group of Polish expatriates trying to establish a back-to-the-land artistic community. The wineries flourished for three decades. The art colony collapsed within a few months. After World War I, the heavily German character of Anaheim gave way to the influence of newer arrivals from the Midwest, who tended to be Protestant and conservative and evangelical about their faith. Reverend Leon L. Myers, pastor of the Anaheim Christian Church and founder of the local men's Bible club, turned the Ku Klux Klan into one of the most powerful organizations in town. Carl's uncle Ben owned Karcher's Feed and Seed Store, right in the middle of downtown Anaheim. Carl worked there 76 hours a week, selling goods to local farmers for their chickens, cattle, and hogs. During Sunday services at St. Boniface Catholic Church, Carl spotted an attractive young woman named Margaret Hines sitting in a nearby pew. He later asked her out for ice cream, and the two began dating. Carl became a frequent visitor to the Heinz farm on North Palm Street. It had 10 acres of orange trees and a Spanish-style house where Margaret, her parents, her 7 brothers, and her 7 sisters lived. The place seemed magical. In the social hierarchy of California's farmers, orange growers stood at the very top. Their homes were set amid fragrant evergreen trees that produced a lucrative income. As a young boy in Ohio, Carl had been thrilled on Christmas mornings to receive a single orange as a gift from Santa. Now, oranges seemed to be everywhere. After briefly returning to Ohio, Carl went to work for the Armstrong Bakery in Los Angeles. The job soon paid $24 a week, $6 more than he'd earned at the feed store, and enough to start a family. Carl and Margaret were married in 1939 and had their first child within a year. Carl drove a truck for the bakery, delivering bread to restaurants and markets in West L.A. He was amazed by the number of hot dog stands that were opening and by the number of buns they went through every week. When Carl heard that a hot dog cart was for sale on Florence Avenue across from the Goodyear factory, he decided to buy it. "I'm in business for myself now," Carl thought after buying the cart. "I'm on my way." He kept his job at the bakery and hired 2 young men to work the cart during the hours he was delivering bread. They sold hot dogs, chili dogs, and tamales for a dime each, soda for a nickel. 5 months after Carl bought the cart, the United States entered World War II, and the Goodyear plant became very busy. Soon, he had enough money to buy a second hot dog cart, which Margaret often ran by herself, selling food and counting change, while their daughters slept nearby in the car. Southern California had recently given birth to an entirely new lifestyle and a new way of eating. Both revolved around cars. The cities back east had been built in the railway era, with central business districts linked to outlying suburbs by commuter train and trolley. But the tremendous growth of Los Angeles occurred at a time when automobiles were finally affordable. Between 1920 and 1940, the population of Southern California nearly tripled, as about 2 million people arrived from across the United States. While cities in the East expanded through immigration and became more diverse, Los Angeles became more homogeneous and white. The city was inundated with middle-class arrivals from the Midwest, especially in the years leading up to the Great Depression. Invalids, retirees, and small businessmen were drawn to Southern California by real estate ads promising a warm climate and a good life. It was the first large-scale migration conducted mainly by car. Los Angeles soon became unlike any other city the world had ever seen, sprawling and horizontal, a thoroughly suburban metropolis of detached homes, a glimpse of the future, molded by the automobile. A new form of eating place emerged. "People with cars are so lazy they don't want to get out of them to eat," said Jesse G. Kirby, the founder of an early drive-in restaurant chain. Kirby's first pig stand was in Texas, but the chain soon thrived in Los Angeles, alongside countless other food stands offering curb service. In the rest of the United States, drive-ins were usually a seasonal phenomenon, closing at the end of every summer. In Southern California, it felt like summer all year long. The drive-ins never closed, and a whole new industry was born. The new drive-ins competed for attention, using all kinds of visual lures, decorating their buildings in bright colors, and dressing their waitresses in various costumes. Known as car hops, the waitresses, who carried trays of food to patrons in parked cars, often wore short skirts and dressed up like cowgirls, majorettes, Scottish lasses, and kilts. They were likely to be attractive, often received no hourly wages, and earned their money through tips and a small commission on every item they sold. The car hops had a strong economic incentive to be friendly to their customers, and drive-in restaurants quickly became popular hangouts for teenage boys. The drive-ins fit perfectly with the youth culture of Los Angeles. They were something genuinely new and different, They offered a combination of girls and cars and late-night food. And before long, they beckoned from intersections all over town. By the end of 1944, Carl Karcher owned 4 hot dog carts in Los Angeles. In addition to running the carts, he still worked full-time for the Armstrong Bakery. When a restaurant across the street from the Heinz Farm went on sale, Carl decided to buy it. He quit the bakery, bought the restaurant, fixed it up, and spent a few weeks learning how to cook. On January 16, 1945, his 28th birthday, Carl's Drive-In Barbecue opened its doors. The restaurant was small, rectangular, and unexceptional, with red tiles on the roof. Its only hint of flamboyance was a 5-pointed star atop the neon sign in the parking lot. During business hours, Carl did the cooking. Margaret worked behind the cash register, and Carhop served most of the food. After closing time, Carl stayed late into the night, cleaning the bathrooms and mopping the floors. Once a week, he prepared the special sauce for his hamburgers, making it in huge kettles on the back porch of his house, stirring it with a stick, and then pouring it into 1-gallon jugs. After World War II, business soared at Carl's Drive-In Barbecue, along with the economy of Southern California. The oil business and the film business had thrived in Los Angeles during the 1920s and 1930s. But it was World War II that transformed Southern California into the most important economic region in the West. Between 1940 and 1945, the federal government spent nearly $20 billion in California, mainly in and around Los Angeles, building airplane factories and steel mills, military bases, and port facilities. While Hollywood garnered most of the headlines, defense spending remained the focus of the local economy for the next 2 decades, providing about 1/3 of its jobs. The new prosperity enabled Carl and Margaret to buy a house 5 blocks away from their restaurant. They added more rooms as the family grew to include 12 children, 9 girls and 3 boys. In the early 1950s, Anaheim began to feel much less rural and remote. Walt Disney bought 160 acres of orange groves just a few miles from Carl's Drive-In Barbecue, chopped down the trees, and started to build Disneyland. The city of Anaheim started to recruit defense contractors, eventually persuading Northrop, Boeing, and North American Aviation to build factories there. Anaheim soon became the fastest-growing city in the nation's fastest-growing state. Carl's Drive-In Barbecue thrived, and Carl thought its future was secure. And then he heard about a restaurant in the Inland Empire, 60 miles east of Los Angeles, that was selling high-quality hamburgers for 15 cents each, 20 cents less than what Carl charged. He drove to East Street in San Bernardino and saw the shape of things to come. Dozens of people were standing in line to buy bags of McDonald's famous hamburgers. Richard and Maurice McDonald had left New Hampshire for Southern California at the start of the Depression, hoping to find jobs in Hollywood. They worked as set builders on the Columbia Film Studios backlot, saved their money, and bought a movie theater in Glendale. The theater was not a success. In 1937, they opened a drive-in restaurant in Pasadena, trying to cash in on the new craze, hiring 3 car hops and selling mainly hot dogs. A few years later, they moved to a larger building on E Street in San Bernardino and opened the McDonald Brothers Burger Bar Drive-In. The new restaurant was located near a high school, employed 20 car hops, and promptly made the brothers rich. Richard and Mac McDonald bought one of the largest houses in San Bernardino, a hillside mansion with a tennis court and a pool. By the end of the 1940s, the McDonald brothers had grown dissatisfied with the drive-in business. They were tired of constantly looking for new car hops and short-order cooks who were in great demand as the old ones left for higher-paying jobs elsewhere. They were tired of replacing the dishes, glassware, and silverware their teenage customers constantly broke or ripped off. And they were tired of their teenage customers. The brothers thought about selling the restaurant. Instead, they tried something new. The McDonald's fired all their car hops in 1948, closed their restaurant, installed larger grills, and reopened 3 months later with a radically new method of preparing food. It was designed to increase the speed, lower prices, and raise the volume of sales. The brothers eliminated almost two-thirds of the items on their old menu. They got rid of everything that had to be eaten with a knife, spoon, or fork. The only sandwiches now sold were hamburgers or cheeseburgers. The brothers got rid of their dishes and glassware, replacing them with paper cups, paper bags, and paper plates. They divided the food preparation into separate tasks performed by different workers. To fill a typical order, one person grilled the hamburger, another dressed and wrapped it, another prepared the milkshake, another made the fries, and another worked the counter. For the first time, the guiding principles of a factory assembly line were applied to a commercial kitchen. The new division of labor meant that a worker only had to be taught how to perform one task. Skilled and expensive short-order cooks were no longer necessary. All of the burgers were sold with the same condiments: ketchup, onions, mustard, and two pickles. No substitutions were allowed. The McDonald Brothers' speedy service system revolutionized the restaurant business. Richard McDonald designed a new building for the restaurant, hoping to make it easy to spot from the road. Though untrained as an architect, he came up with a design that was simple, memorable, and archetypal. On two sides of the roof, he put golden arches, lit by neon at night, that from a distance formed the letter M. The building effortlessly fused advertising with architecture and spawned one of the most famous corporate logos in the world. After visiting San Bernardino and seeing the long lines at McDonald's, Carl Karcher went home to Anaheim and decided to open his own self-service restaurant. Carl instinctively grasped that the new car culture would forever change America. He saw what was coming, and his timing was perfect. The first Carl's Jr. restaurant opened in 1956, the same year that America got its first shopping mall and that Congress passed the Interstate Highway Act. President Dwight D. Eisenhower had pushed hard for such a bill. During World War II, he'd been enormously impressed by Adolf Hitler's Reichsautobahn, the world's first superhighway system. The Interstate Highway Act brought autobahns to the United States and became the largest public works project in the nation's history, building 46,000 miles of road with more than $130 billion of federal money. The new highways spurred car sales, truck sales, and the construction of new suburban homes. Carl's first self-service restaurant was a success, and he soon opened others near California's new freeway off-ramps. The star atop his drive-in sign became the mascot of his fast food chain. It was a smiling star in little booties, holding a burger and a shake. Entrepreneurs from all over the country went to San Bernardino, visited the new McDonald's, and built imitations of the restaurant in their hometowns. "Our food was exactly the same as McDonald's," the founder of a rival chain later admitted. "If I had looked at McDonald's and saw someone flipping hamburgers while he was hanging by his feet, I would have copied it." America's fast food chains were not launched by large corporations relying upon focus groups and market research. They were started by door-to-door salesmen, short-order cooks, orphans, and dropouts, by eternal optimists looking for a piece of the next big thing. The startup costs of a fast food restaurant were low, the profit margins promised to be high, and a wide assortment of ambitious people were soon buying grills and putting up signs. For every fast food idea that swept the nation, there were countless others that flourished briefly or never had a prayer. There were chains with homey names like Sandy's, Carol's, Henry's, Winkie's, and Mr. 15's. Most of all, there were chains named after their main dish: Burger Chef's, Burger Queen's, Burgerville USA's, and Burger Boy Foodoramas. The fast food wars in Southern California, the birth of Jack in the Box, as well as McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Carl's Jr., were especially fierce. One by one, most of the old drive-ins closed, unable to compete against the less expensive self-service burger joints. But Carl kept at it, opening new restaurants up and down the state, following the new freeways. Four of these freeways, the Riverside, the Santa Ana, the Costa Mesa, and the Orange, soon passed through Anaheim. The leading fast food chains spread nationwide. Between 1960 and 1973, the number of McDonald's restaurants grew from roughly 250 to 3,000. The Arab oil embargo of 1973 gave the fast food industry a bad scare, as long lines at gas stations led many to believe that America's car culture was endangered. Amid gasoline shortages, the value of McDonald's stock fell. When the crisis passed, fast food stock prices recovered, and McDonald's intensified its efforts to open urban as well as suburban restaurants. Wall Street invested heavily in the fast food chains, and corporate managers replaced many of the early pioneers. What had begun as a series of small regional businesses became a fast food industry, a major component of the American economy. In 1976, the new headquarters of Carl Karcher Enterprises Incorporated, CKE, was built on the same land in Anaheim where the Heinz Farm had once stood. The opening night celebration was one of the high points of Carl's life. More than 1,000 people gathered for a black tie party at a tent set up in the parking lot. There was dinner and dancing on a beautiful moonlit night. 35 years after buying his first hot dog cart, Carl Karcher now controlled one of the largest privately owned fast food chains in the United States. He owned hundreds of restaurants. He considered many notable Americans to be his friends, including Governor Ronald Reagan, former President Richard Nixon, Gene Autry, Art Linkletter, Lawrence Welk, and Pat Boone. Carl's nickname was Mr. Orange County. He was a benefactor of Catholic charities, a Knight of Malta, a strong supporter of right-to-life causes. He attended private masses at the Vatican with the Pope. And then, despite all the hard work, Carl's luck began to change. During the 1980s, CKE went public, opened Carl's Jr. restaurants in Texas, added higher-priced dinners to the menu, and for the first time, began to expand by selling franchises. The new menu items and the restaurants in Texas fared poorly. The value of CKE's stock fell. In 1988, Carl and half a dozen members of his family were accused of insider trading by the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. They had sold large amounts of CKE stock right before its price tumbled. Carl vehemently denied the charges and felt humiliated by the publicity surrounding the case. Nevertheless, Carl agreed to a settlement with the SEC to avoid a long and expensive legal battle, he said, and paid more than $500,000 in fines. During the early 1990s, a number of Carl's real estate investments proved unwise. When new subdivisions in Anaheim and the Inland Empire went bankrupt, Carl was saddled with many of their debts. He had allowed real estate developers to use his CKE stock as collateral for their bank loans. He became embroiled in more than 24 lawsuits. He suddenly owed more than $70 million to various banks. The falling price of CKE stock hampered his ability to repay the loans. In May of 1992, his brother Don, a trusted advisor and the president of CKE, died. The new president tried to increase sales at Carl's Jr. restaurants by purchasing food of a lower quality and cutting prices. The strategy began to drive customers away. As the chairman of CKE, Carl searched for ways to save his company and pay off his debts. He proposed selling Mexican food at Carl's Jr. restaurants as part of a joint venture with a chain called Green Burrito. But some executives at CKE opposed the plan, arguing that it would benefit Carl much more than the company. Carl had a financial stake in the deal. Upon its acceptance by the board of CKE, he would receive a $6 million personal loan from Green Burrito. Carl was outraged that his motives were being questioned and that his business was being run into the ground. CKE now felt like a much different company than the one he'd founded. The new management team had ended the longtime practice of starting every executive meeting with a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi and the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Carl insisted that the Green Burrito plan would work and demanded that the board of directors vote on it. When the board rejected the plan, Carl tried to oust its members. Instead, they ousted him. On March 1, 1993, CKE's board voted 5-2 to fire Carl N. Karcher. Only Carl and his son Carl Leo opposed the dismissal. Carl felt deeply betrayed. He had known many of the board members for years. They were old friends. He had made them rich. In a statement released after the firing, Carl described the CKE board as a bunch of turncoats and called it one of the saddest days of his life. At the age of 76, more than five decades after starting the business, Carl N. Karcher was prevented from entering his own office, and new locks were put on the doors. The headquarters of CKE is still located on the property where the Hines family once grew oranges. Today, there's no smell of citrus in the air, no orange groves in sight. In a town that once had endless rows of orange and lemon trees stretching far as the eye could see, there's not an acre of them left, not a single acre devoted to commercial citrus growing. Anaheim's population is now about 300,000, roughly 30 times what it was when Carl first arrived. The CKE building has a modern Spanish design, with white columns, red brick arches, and dark plate glass windows. When I visited recently, it was cool and quiet inside. After passing a life-size wooden statue of St. Francis of Assisi on a stairway landing, I was greeted at the top of the stairs by Carl N. Karcher. Carl looked like a stylish figure from the big band era, wearing a brown checked jacket, a white shirt, a brown tie, and jaunty two-tone shoes. He was tall and strong, and seemed in remarkably good shape. The walls of his office were covered with plaques and mementos, with photographs of Carl beside presidents, famous ballplayers, former employees, grandchildren, priests, cardinals, Mikhail Gorbachev, the Pope. Carl proudly removed a framed object from the wall and handed it to me. It was the original receipt for $326, confirming the purchase of his first hot dog cart. 8 weeks after being locked out of his office in 1993, Carl engineered a takeover of the company. Through a complex series of transactions, a partnership headed by financier William P. Foley II assumed some of Carl's debts, received much of his stock in return, and took control of CKE. Foley became the new chairman of the board. Carl was named chairman emeritus and got his old office back. Almost all of the executives and directors who had opposed him subsequently left the company. The Green Burrito plan was adopted and proved a success. The new management at CKE seemed to have turned the company around, raising the value of its stock. In July of 1997, CKE purchased Hardee's for $327 million, thereby becoming the fourth largest hamburger chain in the United States, joining McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's at top. And signs bearing the Carl's Jr. smiling star started going up across the United States. Carl seemed amazed by his own life story as he told it. He'd been married to Margaret for 60 years. He'd lived in the same Anaheim house for almost 50 years. He had 20 granddaughters and 20 grandsons. For a man of 80, he had an impressive memory, quickly rattling off names, dates, and addresses from half a century ago. He exuded the genial optimism and good humor of his old friend Ronald Reagan. "My whole philosophy is never give up," Carl told me. "The word can't should not exist. Have a great attitude. Watch the pennies and the dollars will take care of themselves. Life is beautiful. Life is fantastic. And that is how I feel about every day of my life." Despite CKE's expansion, Carl remained millions of dollars in debt. he'd secured new loans to pay off the old ones. During the worst of his financial troubles, advisors pleaded with him to declare bankruptcy. Carl refused. He'd borrowed more than $8 million from family members and friends, and he would not walk away from his obligations. Every weekday, he was attending Mass at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting to the office by 7. "My goal in the next 2 years," he said, "is to pay off all my debts." I looked out the window and asked how he felt driving through Anaheim today, with its fast food restaurants, subdivisions, and strip malls. "Well, to be frank about it," he said, "I couldn't be happier." Thinking that he'd misunderstood the question, I rephrased it, asking if he ever missed the old Anaheim, the ranches and citrus groves. "No," he answered. "I believe in progress." Carl grew up on a farm without running water or electricity. He'd escaped a hard rural life. The view outside his office window was not disturbing to him, I realized. It was a mark of success. "When I first met my wife," Carl said, "this road here was gravel, and now it's blacktop." Your trusted friends. Before entering the Ray A. Kroc Museum, you have to walk through McStore. Both sit on the ground floor of McDonald's corporate headquarters, located at 1 McDonald's Plaza in Oak Brook, Illinois. The headquarters building has oval windows and a gray concrete facade, a look that must have seemed space-age when the building opened 3 decades ago. Now it seems stolid and drab, an architectural relic of the Nixon era. It resembles the American Embassy compounds that always used to attract anti-war protesters, student demonstrators, flag burners. The 80-acre campus of Hamburger University, McDonald's managerial training center, is a short drive from headquarters. Shuttle buses constantly go back and forth between the campus and McDonald's Plaza, ferrying clean-cut young men and women in khakis who've come to study for their degree in hamburgerology. The course lasts 2 weeks and trains a few thousand managers, executives, and franchisees each year. Students from out of town stay at the Hyatt on the McDonald's campus. Most of the classes are devoted to personnel issues, teaching lessons in teamwork and employee motivation, promoting a common McDonald's language and a common McDonald's culture. 3 flagpoles stand in front of McDonald's Plaza, the heart of the hamburger empire. One flies the Stars and Stripes, another flies the Illinois state flag, and the third flies a bright red flag with golden arches. You can buy beanbag McBurglar dolls at McStore, or telephones shaped like French fries, ties, clocks, keychains, golf bags and duffel bags, jewelry, baby clothes, lunchboxes, mouse pads, leather jackets, postcards, toy trucks, and much more, all of it bearing the stamp of McDonald's. At the back of McStore, past the footsteps of Ronald McDonald stenciled on the floor, past the shelves of dishes and glassware, a bronze bust of Ray Kroc marks the entrance to his museum. Kroc was the founder of the McDonald's Corporation, and his philosophy of QSC&V, quality, service, cleanliness, and value, still guided. The man immortalized in bronze is balding and middle-aged, with smooth cheeks and an intense look in his eyes. A glass display case nearby holds plaques, awards, and letters of praise. Other glass cases contain artifacts of Kroc's life, mementos of his long years of struggle and his twilight as a billionaire. The museum is small and dimly lit, displaying each object with reverence. The day I visited, the place was empty and still. It didn't feel like a traditional museum, where objects are coolly numbered, cataloged, and described. It felt more like a shrine. Many of the exhibits at the Ray A. Kroc Museum incorporate neat technological tricks. Dioramas appear and then disappear when certain buttons are pushed. The voices of Kroc's friends and co-workers, one of them identified as a McDonald's Vice President of Individuality, boom from speakers at the appropriate cue. Darkened glass cases are suddenly illuminated from within, revealing their contents. An artwork on the wall, when viewed from the left, displays an image of Ray Kroc. Viewed from the right, It shows the letters QSC and V.